That's character. It used to be part of American culture, didn't it? Used to be that if you hired somebody to do a job, you didn't have to check on them to make sure they would do it. It was part of the pride of being a human in this country that you did the right thing. We've changed, haven't we, collectively? So even the church, because it's conformed so much to the world, it's hard to find people who would deliberately choose to do what's right for no other reason other than it's right. So I was sort of intrigued by this, starting this chapter heading, and at the same time I just read the thing in Hebrews, and at the same time that I had just made this painful choice. Here's what he said. The next thing he said was, to learn how to do what is right simply because it's right would be impossible if the actions were immediately rewarded and if the choices were never costly. Just run that over in your brain. Think about that. I had enough, in fact, my second major in college was psychology. And I did enough studies on behavior modification, all of those kinds of experiments that they did way back in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s when I was in college. And they've, you know, found out that you could get a rat to make whatever choice you wanted it to make based on reward down one road and pain down another road. Oh, let's switch them back and forth. And the rat's going to choose reward over pain anytime. Here's the thing that God spoke to me, and it was true for me. I've since come to realize that it's true for many, many church people. They do the right things for one of two reasons. One is the fear of punishment, and the other is to earn a reward. And that's pretty human. We start out that way. We don't do certain things because we don't want to get punished, and we do certain things that we think is going to get us goodies. Both of those are immature reasons for doing the right thing. Both of those things are not like Jesus, are they? If you want to be following Jesus' model, everything he did purely because it was the right thing to do in obedience to his Father. Reward wasn't in his mind. Fear of punishment wasn't in his mind. So here I am, I'm reading this chapter, and all of a sudden I realized I have avoided the opportunity to learn how to choose the right thing simply because it's the right thing, because I always chose against pain. And I hope I'm making this clear. I looked up that Hebrews 5:8 scripture again, and it seemed to me that the pivotal word was the word learned. Even though Jesus was a son, he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. That has to mean that he didn't learn obedience by disobeying and suffering for the disobedience, right? Because he didn't disobey. I had never heard anybody talk about this before up until that point. So I looked the word learned up. I wrote it in your little quote here. I put it in parentheses. It means to learn something by use and practice so that you become in the habit of doing something. Interesting word. It's a fat word. So Jesus learned by use and practice to be in the habit of obedience through the things that he suffered. It's not the way we think, is it? A lot of children, I think, are raised in the completely wrong way because we don't understand this as parents. We don't put them in positions of making costly choices for what's right. And so what happens is they never make a choice for what's right unless there's something in it for them. And as a result, they don't turn out to be people who choose what's right simply because it's right. Because the way that you learn to do that is when you do the right thing and you get punched in the nose for it. The people that are going to stick with it and grow and be like Jesus and live like Jesus are going to be people that are going to make the choice, even if they are going to suffer. They're going to make the choice for what God wants, for the right thing. Somebody was telling me tonight that they teach the Marines. Was it you was telling me they used to teach the Marines that? I don't know if they still do. You do the right thing because it's the right thing. Whether anybody agrees with you, whether people think you're nuts, whether it's going to cost you, that's how that becomes our habit. Now, verse 17, I believe, ties in with verse 1 and 2 of chapter 4. If you can follow me, this it seems very clear to me. I'm not always good at explaining it in as clear and linear a way as it runs through my brain. Why would God choose for those who are doing the right thing to suffer? Why would he deliberately choose that? Because we know God chooses to take away suffering sometimes. It has to be because there's a good reason for it, and to choose it is better than to choose to relieve the suffering and take the suffering away. We've already seen Peter tell us one reason. I think this is the other reason. The first reason is, Peter says several times, is because that's the greatest witness that we have in a world that doesn't think that way. When you live for Jesus and you choose what he chooses, and it brings inconvenience or suffering or uncomfortableness in your life, it catches people's attention. And the ones that don't just write you off as being an idiot realize that you're serious about this and that maybe it's worth investigating. And Peter tells us over and over that that's one of the reasons why we suffer for doing good. We make the choice that we're going to do the Jesus thing no matter what, no matter what anybody else does. And that is going to give glory to God. That's one reason why God would choose suffering. For those that are purposing to do good. The other reason, I think, is what Peter says right here in verses 1 and 2, and it ties in with the little handout that I gave you. Since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves with the same attitude because, here's this little phrase, you can just whiz right through it. He who has suffered in his body, once again, that suffered physically because of Christ or because of doing the right thing, that person is done with sin. What does that mean? Does that mean he doesn't ever sin? Well, one of the things that we realize is that all of us who have purposed in our hearts to do the right thing still stumble. What it means, in fact, I'll give you the word if you're interested, and I'll even give you the verb tense. This is a lot funner when Fred and Nancy are here because they get Greek verb tenses, but I know some of you write this down and you go check me out, and I love that. The word that's translated done with sin, it's a verb. The Greek word is the word pao. Remember we looked at that last week? We looked at it because it's a lot like the Hawaiian word for over or finished. Interestingly, it means for something to end or to cease, or you intervene before and don't allow something to continue by choice, willfully. The verb tense, if you're interested, is perfect indicative, which is past action with present and continuing results. So what it's saying is, when your commitment to the Lord is so strong that you're willing to have it take a chunk out of your body, when it causes you pain to do the right thing, you're not sitting on the fence anymore on the sin issue. You made a decision. You chose against your flesh, and you've solidified the decision to choose for doing what's right. And that's the value. And why God allows that. It cements that choice. Boy, there are so many little spin-offs to this. One of them is just to look at historical Christianity and see how the church always flourished in persecution. You know, when the church started rotting was when we had wealth and influence and political power. The biggest maniacs that ever tried to stamp out the church could not diminish it. People still were committed to the Lord. It's really interesting to me. I remember reading Hudson Taylor's biography and ministering in China in the days where just open hostility and persecution against the church. And people were getting saved all the time. People were coming to Jesus, knowing that it could cost them their life. I remember the last time I heard Gospel for Asia guy speak, he was talking about the revival that's going on in some Muslim countries right now. You never hear about it. People making choices to follow Jesus after hearing the gospel when they know, according to the Quran anyway, if you convert to Christianity from Islam, it's a death sentence. Now, not all Muslim countries carry it out to that degree. But there are people that are large numbers of them making a decision to walk with Jesus when they know their life's never going to be the same again. They're standing in society, they're standing with their family, and their very life itself may be forfeited. So persecution didn't really ever stop the church. There's that phenomenon. It tends to, let me read you what my NIV study notes say about verse 2. The one who suffered in his body for Jesus is finished with sin. He's made up his mind. He's off the fence on the sin issue. And as a result, he doesn't live the rest of his life, his earthly life, for human desires, but for the will of God. Here's what my study Bible says. Such suffering enables one to straighten out his priorities. And sinful desires and practices that once seemed important now seem insignificant when one's life is in jeopardy. Serious suffering for Christ advances the progress of sanctification. It's that learning by use and practice to be in the habit of obedience through suffering. It's exercising that power of choice. By the way, when I took that fork in the road that led to pain, which God gave me the opportunity, there have been many since then. One of them involved moving out here. That particular one, the first one, was the most painful. In fact, that God didn't, he didn't make it easy. He let it be hard. It's another mistake parents make. We don't let character be formed by kids making the right choice and then let it be hard. We want it to be easy, and no character's ever been formed by making choices towards comfort and easiness. You know what I mean? You're smart people. God's the perfect parent. It does look backwards. It looks like if you suffer, nobody's going to want to serve God. Well, not true. But it will weed out the people that really do and the people that just say they do. You know what I mean? In that particular choice that God let me make, two things happened. It was the worst pain I'd ever known up until that point, and it lasted a long time, a couple of years. And he didn't let it be easy. It didn't last forever. But here's the other thing. He came closer to me. I don't even know how to explain it to you. Those of you that have suffered in that kind of a way and have surrendered your heart to him in trust and love for him, have found closeness with him that you never knew before, that I never experienced. And of course, I always had taken the inferior choice before. I took the choice of, okay, I'm not going to choose evil over good, but I'll just choose a less painful good. You know? Not complete obedience, just sort of what's in it for me, obedience. You know what I mean? Which is not really obedient sometimes. But he came close to me, and I learned things about him that are part of who I am today. And I got muscles that I needed to have for what was coming down the pike later in my life. That was my experience. And I think that Peter is, if you tie both of these like a sandwich, you know, one piece of bread is verse 17 and the other piece of bread is verses 1 and 2 of chapter 4 and everything in between them. But if you put those two things together, you see that one of the reasons that God allows those that are choosing right to suffer, even perhaps to die, as many of the people Peter was writing to, that's what they faced. Number one, he knew that Jesus was going to come close to those people in a way that they'd never seen before. But he also knew that you're never more like Jesus than you are when you choose to do the right thing simply because you're doing what God says to do. Especially when you know it will cost you. I think the phrase in the John Wyndham quote that stuck out to me, and I tell you, I've had this for years up someplace where I can see it. It's that immediately rewarded thing. You know how often we say, Lord, I will follow. And then it's hard, and we know it's hard, and so we make the choice, okay, Lord, I'll choose your way. And then we're just expecting to be just flooded with wonderfulness and reward. And sometimes we don't not only do not get the reward, sometimes it gets harder. Sometimes you take that road, and it's and then you're starting to think, well, wait a minute, where's this reward thing here? I do think if we see it properly, his closeness will become our reward. And we'll see that there's a preciousness. The Bible calls it the fellowship of sharing in his suffering. Okay, that's my first rabbit trail. And I hate to jump all the way from 17 down to verses 1 and 2 of chapter 4, but I believe that's what Peter is saying. And then in verse 1 of chapter 4, he says, look, we have the example of what Jesus did. And he tells the whole story. He came, he suffered unbelievably, but that was so we could come to God. That wasn't even for him. That was pure love. It was God's plan. He obeyed, even though it cost him his life. Now, he died, but he didn't stay dead. He rose from the dead. And where is he now? Well, now he's sitting in the position of authority. And right on the heels of telling that whole story, Peter says, okay, there's your model. There's the template. So arm yourself with the same attitude. And I think that the same attitude is what verse 2 of chapter 4 is saying. Not living for yourself anymore. Not living for the comfortable way. Living for God's will. I have to tell you, it's not all suffering. Remember what we learned from the book of Job. Suffering for the believer isn't the whole story. And it's certainly not the end of the story. It may be the middle of the story. It may be a couple of chapters in the middle of the story. But the end is fabulous. And God only allows those chapters of suffering in order for the end to be fabulous. It's not arbitrary. It's not because he's not paying attention. It's not because he's angry. It's pure love. It says, here's something I want to give you that is more precious than you can realize. Yeah, it is going to be bumpy ride for a little while. You're going to have to make choice simply to do what's right every day because it's the right thing. But you're going to have something that's more precious than gold. And you're going to have something that brings you close to him. Now, Peter is writing this to people who need to hear these words maybe more than we do. Speaking of Hudson Taylor, one thing that jumped out at me in his biography, he talked about a young American missionary that heard about the revival in China. So he came over and he held this big meeting and he was shocked that anybody came, but throngs of people came and hundreds of people accepted Jesus. And when he was visiting with Hudson Taylor, this famous missionary, afterwards, he was just glowing, and he was talking about, wow, these are such wonderful, look at how many converts I have, look at how many converts. And he said, and Hudson Taylor was not smiling. And he looked at him, and here's what he said. He said, do you realize that if what you told these people is not the truth, you just murdered them? If you're not absolutely convinced in your heart that what you told them is the truth, you signed a death sentence for them. Do you understand that when they believed what you said, they staked their lives on it? And this young man was so sobered because he came from America where it doesn't cost anything to be a Christian. He didn't never even thought of that. He was just glad that he won, you know? Hundreds of people agreed with him and made the decision. He didn't know what it was going to cost them. Sobering, isn't it? I'm not trying to make anybody feel guilty for not being persecuted. I'm glad we're not being persecuted. But it's one of the reasons why Americans are flaky in their commitment compared to other countries. It doesn't cost us anything. They're pretty shallow commitments sometimes. God has a better plan than that. He wants me to do the right thing for the right reason, not just because I think I'm going to get a reward or because I'm afraid of going to hell. He wants to make me just like Jesus. And that's one of the ways that he does it. He wants me to be a son who chooses what's right even when it's costly. Isn't that what you would want from your sons and your daughters? You would certainly want them to be that kind of people, wouldn't you? So, back to verse 18. That's just the first, actually, technically, that's three verses, not just one verse, because we did look at the first part of chapter 4. If it's God's will, if God deliberately chooses for his good purposes that you suffer, it'd be good if it was for doing good and not for doing evil. And then he uses Jesus as the example. And if you take all the next five or six verses in a row, he's just painting the whole picture of Jesus suffering, what it cost him for us to come to God. Here's a sobering question that I've thought of as I read verse 18. Would I be willing to suffer just so other people could be brought to God? We don't think about that, do we? I think about that about jobs. I was thinking about what Mark was saying about, you know, having a job he didn't really want to do. I think about that almost every day about me living in Maine. What if God, and it's a beautiful place. And there's people I love here. So it's not like he sent me to, I say I don't dare pick a name of another place, I'll get somebody mad at me. On a sliding scale, George MacDonald had a wonderful definition of suffering. He said, suffering means having something you don't want or not having something you do want or being somewhere you don't want to be or not being somewhere you do want to be. And that in broadest terms, that's what suffering means. Does God have my permission to put me any place that he wants, even if it's uncomfortable, even if it's painful, for the sake of others being brought to him? Well, if Jesus is my model, that is something that and ultimately, God doesn't have to tell me the whys he's doing things, but the more I know about his methods and his reasons, the easier it is for me. Every choice that he makes, even the ones that are painful, are for good. Ultimately, they will be for my good. They may not be overtly for my good. It might not be about me. It might be so that somebody else has somebody who chooses to do right in their life. You know how many people there are like that out there? Do you know very many? I don't know very many. And so the darker the place is, the nastier the place is, the more rude and mean church people are, the more hostile non-church people are towards Christ, the more important it is that there be people planted there who live their lives for Jesus, right? Calvary Chapel pastor from Georgia, I think near, he's from the really near where Milton Roberta were up in the mountains there. He spoke at a pastor's conference and he said something